Coming up next on RCR, it's the dialogue with Dewa De Boer from politics.
So we sort of have a crossroads, as it were, here in New Zealand.
To power.
You know, when good men stand up, the spines of others are stiffened.
And culture.
Through times like this, you know, through adversity, you can see who you can trust, who you can rely on. You see who's standing with you, and all of these things are very, very valuable.
Tune in on Fridays, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon. It is just afternoon, once again, midday. Good to be back at the midday slot, but it has been a bit of a change. I'm here on Monday. So welcome to this first Monday edition of The Dialogue, and I am your host, Dewa De Boer. If you're a new listener who's never tuned in before, perhaps you like to listen to RCR only on Mondays, I do really hope you will enjoy the show. Do come back next week for a full show, because it's been a little bit of a rush to get a second show prepared within 3 days of the previous one. So we may end up a little bit short on my planning and have a replay at the end, but I do have some interesting topics to get through. And thank you as well very much to Paul, Jess Spreet, and Don for this morning's programming. Excellent, as always. Now, first up, I would like to go through some research that I did into some polls that have been done into Trump support in New Zealand in the last 8 years. And this analysis will be up on the RCR blog. It's what I put it together for. It may be already there, or it may end up there a little later on in the week. Then after that, we will be joined again by recurring guest Kaiden McCormick. And we were hoping to have a round table with some of our other friends. And I know that all of you regular listeners enjoy those, but we couldn't quite sync everything up this week. We will make it happen in the future. I enjoy every conversation I have with the other members at Right Minds NZ, but it is not often that we get to record our conversations to share. Most of what we talk about is perhaps too controversial for radio anyway, but the subject of Russian and Ukrainian special forces in Africa is the pitch for today, so I hope you will stick around for it. I've got a book review as well. It's been a while since I've done a book review. They tend to take a long time to write, so I don't do them that often. And this is not actually one of the books that I was planning to review, but I ended up researching the right-wing bodybuilding sphere and their influences, especially on wealthier and elite Americans, say men like Elon Musk, the PayPal Mafia, and even others who have moved from YouTube careers, like Felix Schellberg, known as PewDiePie. And while doing some of this research, I read the book Bronze Age Mindset, and I have some thoughts about it that I will share with you later. And I did write that initially for goodoil.news, so do support them as well if you're supporting RCR. It's great to be part of a larger network of good new media in New Zealand that challenges the legacy media. I will also deliver on the retelling of Napoleon's final battle at Waterloo. I've been promising that for a few weeks, and it's going to happen this afternoon. And we will also have a little look at what happens this week in New Zealand history. And if we need to, then, as I said, there will be a replay at the end, but that's going to depend on how quickly I get through this. So before we get to the key interview in this show, let's have a look at the analysis of Trump support in New Zealand over the last 8 years. And much was made of an August poll by the New Zealand Herald that showed, and I quote, "most New Zealanders support Kamala Harris," end quote, perhaps unsurprisingly. Her support was 55% in that poll, with Donald Trump at a mere 21%. But I found that the least interesting observation of all time, and no legacy media journalist did the analysis that should have been done on the breakdown of this poll and also the trend of previous polls. So I've done some investigative journalism, though I don't wish to taint myself with the charge of journalism, so we'll just call it commentary, investigation, analysis. So the poll that they ran in 2024, they had previously run in 2016. And then in the year 2020, that was the previous election, The Conversation also did a survey, quite a large one that was fairly scientific. So these three polls and surveys paint a very interesting picture. Donald Trump's support in 2016 was 9%. In 2020, it was 11%. And in 2024, it was 23%. So that's more than doubling in the last 4 years, and basically 2.5 times his support since the New Zealand Herald ran their first poll 8 years ago. So what's changed? No journalist bothered to ask that question. Clearly, an increasing number of New Zealanders are unplugging from the mainstream media and are making more independent choices. And in my opinion, this is a situation that is leading to a more balanced view of Trump. We see this happening very, very rapidly. And now when we look at the age breakdown of this poll, we can see that disconnecting, unplugging, or being uninfluenced by the mainstream media has a very large correlation with support for President Donald Trump. We see that 28% of 18 to 29-year-olds favor Trump. We see 25% of 30 to 44-year-olds, but then only 16% of 45 to 59-year-olds, and a mere 13% of 60s and over who voice support for Donald Trump in this polling. So we see that the support is declining very rapidly with older audiences who are more likely to watch the 6 o'clock news or to consume legacy media that has a very heavy anti-Trump bias. And younger New Zealanders are more than twice as likely to support Trump as older New Zealanders. So the Zoomers, as we call them, are very much in favor of Trump compared to the Boomers, who are not. And this, I think, is a very positive sign. Now, among Kiwi men and Kiwi women, we also see a similar divide. Only 11% of women support Trump versus 31% of men. Now, the New Zealand Herald Tabot Mills poll didn't provide a breakdown for young men versus young women, but if we infer a similar split, it's possible that there's an outright majority of young men in New Zealand who support Trump. That, in my opinion, is quite a significant insight. Now, there's also an aspect of the poll that did get some attention, which was the breakdown by political party. So only New Zealand First voters had a greater support of Trump over Harris, and only New Zealand First Act and the Māori Party did not have a majority support for Harris. So we see 48% of New Zealand First voters favor Trump, 32% of ACT voters favor Trump, only 26% of National voters favor Trump, 18% of Māori Party voters support Trump, and I note here that the Māori Party support for Trump is the greater than all the other left-wing parties. Perhaps there's something significant or useful to consider here. And then we see Labour only has a 14% support for Trump, and the Green Party a measly 8% support for Trump. Although I think that's quite positive, seeing your average Green voter, it might be good to know that almost 1 in 10 Green voters could be Trump supporters. Now, the really big takeaway for me is that alternatives to the legacy media, such as Reality Check Radio, who allow the hosts like myself and my guests to speak freely and positively about Trump, is having a very big impact. And there's also a growing gap for new media that speaks to younger people who are very rapidly shifting their political views to favor populist and patriotic leaders. Now, we will have some classical music before we go to our interview with Kaiden, and I have selected a piece by the Russian composer Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky. And I know we're going to be talking about the military contractors Wagner, but Wagner was a German composer, so we'll do some music from Wagner later on in the show. But first, a short piece by Tchaikovsky, the Nutcracker March. And the Nutcracker was one of his famous ballets. And this beautiful classical ballet contains a few armies and the marching that they do. He composed some beautiful marching music for that. And so since we're going to be talking about some military matters today, I thought that would be quite suitable. You're listening to The Dialogue with Diwa de Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. And you can text us on 2057 and email inbox at realitycheck.radio with any thoughts you might have during this interview. And we are joined now by Kaiden McCormick, who is a regular guest on the show. We've previously talked about Vladimir Putin and also about Haiti. So welcome back to the show, Kaiden.
Welcome, Diwa. It's good to be here.
And in some kind of roundabout way, I think we're going to put together a few of the things we've talked about previously, although there's going to be a brand new subject. We're going to be focusing on Africa today. And the pitch that you made to me for this discussion, which was going to be a round table at one point, but it's ended up being just the two of us. And the pitch was Ukrainian and Russian special forces in Africa. And I thought that's quite an intriguing situation going on over there in Africa. But before we focus on, you know, why these Russian and Ukrainian special forces might be in Africa and where they are, I thought we'd quickly touch base on Haiti, because we talked about it now several months ago, and we had a little look in the news just before on what's happened there. You theorized at the time that some African countries would actually go and be brought in to restore order. And it seems to sort of have been attempted. I see that the Kenyan police ended up in there, which I do believe was your prediction. But they've basically been a complete failure, and it's completely dropped out of the news, and the entire place is falling apart in the same way that it was back when we did the discussion about it.
Yeah, nothing ever changes, right? Now they've just announced they're in a state of emergency. And I mean, I don't see this changing anytime soon, to be honest. I just saw the other day that they're moving in thousands of Haitians into the States, into small towns, and culturally enriching them. So the solution seems to be, instead of fixing Haiti, you just bring the people from Haiti to the States.
Yes, I saw several towns there in the United States with, say, a population of 4,000 or something, and then having 2,000 Haitian refugees brought in. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was something like half the town's population suddenly turning up overnight. And that's going to be a big problem in the United States. And I see that Donald Trump is increasing his election rhetoric on this as well. Clearly not a good solution for them. But with Haiti being unfixable, and it being a former French colony, we've also got a whole bunch of former French colonies in Africa. And the focus today, hopefully, will be mostly on West Africa. What exactly is going on there in the Sahel region in Africa, where we know that Russian and Ukrainian special forces are operating?
Well, what's going on there is essentially a proxy war being fought between the West and Russia, whereby Russia is using Wagner as its sort of agent to flip or support some of these West African regimes that are turning their back on France. So the three that we'll focus on will be Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. So they're all landlocked countries in the West. And so it's in this area called the Sahel region. It's this 1,000 kilometer belt between the savannas to the south around Sudan, and then to the north is the Sahara Desert. And so it's this sort of semi-arid, it's not quite a wasteland, but, you know, it's not very easy to grow food. It's not very resource dense, or at least the resources haven't been exploited yet. And they're quite remote. So these three countries have just made up a recent alliance called the Alliance of Sahel States. You know, don't read out the acronym out loud, right? But
the ASS.
Yes, the ASS.
That's going to stick. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't think that through, did they? So these three states are relatively underdeveloped. They're, like a lot of other sub-Saharan Africa states, wildly corrupt, high crime rates, at least the crime that you can report. But also they've turned against the West and against the French, who sort of had them as dependencies for quite a while. So
this is an ongoing decolonization in Africa. I think we often talk about decolonization in Africa as happening in the past, but the French maintained a bit of a stronger grip, I think, on many of their colonies, especially in West Africa. And decolonization is continuing. They're being pushed out. And in that process of decolonization, several different factions are looking at stepping into that gap, some new new colonization, or sort of it doesn't end in terms of outside influence. So interesting to see Russia stepping into the gap there, and I suspect China will be involved in a small way as well. And as I understand it, they also have big problems with terrorism in that general region. So could you explain sort of the geopolitical situation there? Because the Arabs and the Muslims are quite populous in that area.
So it mostly goes back to early 2012 when Gaddafi gets toppled. He had been using these nomadic Berber peoples called the Tuareg. There's a few others in that region north of Mali. So Gaddafi is toppled and all those weapons end up equipping these nomadic peoples. And they decide, well, we're going to establish our own state as separatists. And now that they're like heavily equipped, because beforehand there had always been, you know, an issue for the country of Mali. They'd always been, you know, attempting independence, let's say. But only now they've been equipped with like DSHK machine guns and, you know, technicals with rocket launchers on the back. So they've got pretty heavy ordnance now, and they managed to take a significant amount of northern Mali. And all the while, you have this uprising of Sunni Muslim, meaning they are basically terrorist organizations. So you've got the Al-Qaeda branch of the Sahara. There's a particular acronym, but I mean, you can just think of them as Al-Qaeda. They've got the Islamic State, essentially, in this area a bit later on. And so they're causing a lot of chaos for Mali, and you know, the legitimate government of Mali is struggling. The French troops that are stationed there, okay, they go around killing a few jihadists, but they're not dealing with a major threat to these countries' legitimacy. And so this spreads from Mali into neighboring countries of Burkina Faso and Niger. And eventually, you know, you see this spread into Nigeria, Chad, and all these other West African states.
And the borders in these countries, I believe, were sort of drawn up by the French as well in a large part to split up ethnic groups and kind of put power in the hands of the tribes that the French favored. And there seems to be quite a bit of kind of cross-border tribes that have, or ethnic groups that are placed across both sides of the borders in many of these countries. And so it's a potentially breakaway states or larger, I suspect a large part of this is ethnic conflict basically that goes back, like tribal warfare is what I'm trying to say. This tribal warfare that goes back centuries in many cases, right?
And it's impossible for them to even police these borders because they're so wide and the funding isn't there. The you know, organization certainly isn't there. So, you know, they do tend to get overrun. And as a result, there's, you know, all these atrocities and so on.
And you've had French troops there, perhaps the United Nations as well. How has that failed then in recent years since Russia's been able to step into this gap? The only way that Russia can step in is if Western countries are basically not bothering anymore.
Yeah, so essentially how France has operated the region so far is what someone, I guess, like Noam Chomsky, you know, one of these sort of left-wing, activist types, they'd call it a form of neocolonialism. So these West African countries, not all of them, but they generally held together in an economic union called ECOWAS. And ECOWAS stands for the Economic Community of West African States. And a lot of these countries use the West African franc. And this is essentially a currency that is backed by the French. You know, the French have this sort of relationship where 50% of the foreign reserves have to be held in the French banks of each of these, you know, countries. And that gives them a lot of sway over the way that they run their economies. But at the same time, the French aren't doing any form of nation building, right? They're not putting in the type of elites or, say, dictators, right? Because that's always what ends up happening, who want to build up the capital base of their countries. You're not getting a Park Chung-hee or a Lee Kuan Yew, you're getting someone who's, you know, just there to loot and pillage his own countrymen. So all the while, they're not even able to provide basic security for the civilian population there. And these African leaders in West Africa and the ASS are not happy with that.
And there must be a decrease then with French influence then in terms of pushing out the French franc, the franc as well, the currency, the banking reserves that are being held in France. They must be decoupling themselves from that as well, or?
Yeah, there's an attempt to, by ECOWAS, to reform the West African franc into its own currency, but that's still a work in progress at the moment. So, and who knows what will happen with these breakaway states.
And the exploitation of minerals is usually, people who oppose colonization will complain, are they colonists, the Europeans, they came and they stripped these countries of resources, and that's why they're so poor. But we've seen a massive gold boom in West Africa recently, a whole bunch of other rare earth minerals as well, used for, say, building electric cars and so on that everybody likes to use. A lot of those minerals are still located in Africa. They haven't all been pillaged. And I think you referenced this earlier, basically saying there's not really a utilization of the resources. So the British tended to leave good infrastructure. It seems like the French didn't really bother to leave good infrastructure, but they're, as far as we can tell, there is a massive amount of wealth in each of these West African countries, and whoever can actually exploit it properly will end up being extremely wealthy, right? There's a potential for, say, the Gulf states kind of situation to emerge in West Africa if you have the right people who are making the money and actually trying to build something with it rather than just personal enrichment, looting the treasury as it's going on at the moment.
Yeah, so right now, yeah, there's this sort of gold rush happening. A lot of the gold mines in these states are, these countries are sort of, yeah, they're untapped. They have a term for it, like artisanal mining, which essentially means child labor to, you know, like, what's the term that they use, like gold panning, right? Where you kind of collect a bunch of soil and then pan it out for gold. It's that sort of process, very unofficial, you know, just mining on the surface level. They haven't had any access to Western equipment until quite recently. And so, back in the 90s, Senegal started being exploited for gold and they found massive deposits. And this attracted a lot of workers from neighboring countries like Mali and started to industrialize a lot of these mines. And this idea that Senegal had these untapped gold deposits spread to Mali and these other countries. And so more recently, Wagner's been the private military company that we're about to talk about has been given access to a lot of these mines, essentially like running them entirely themselves to help fund their operation. But we don't even know how much they're being funded, like how much gold is being tapped at the moment, because it's really new territory for everyone.
So most people will know Wagner, the Russian private military company, from Bakhmut, which is a big battle in Ukraine last year that went on for months and months. Basically, it was called a meat grinder. Wagner were accused of using human wave tactics and throwing convicts and prisoners in, into this densely built up urban area in Bakhmut. And then they attempted a coup on Vladimir Putin. Their leader, Prigozhin, was stopped, or he surrendered, and he was sent over to Belarus, and then he was assassinated very shortly after that.
Well, we don't know that yet. We don't know that yet. His plane mysteriously blew up in midair. You know, he tempted fate.
Yeah, that's right. It was a plane malfunction while he was traveling between Belarus and Russia, and he was in no way assassinated by Vladimir Putin. That's a completely...
Well, it's conjecture.
Far-fetched story, right? So... But what happened to Wagner after that then? Because I believe what was reported is that Wagner was basically, all of Wagner was in Ukraine. They were then pulled out, many of them placed in Belarus. So what is Wagner doing in Africa? Was there a prehistory to Wagner in terms of its operations in Africa then?
So I guess you can link Wagner all the way back to 2010, before they were even established, where the former founder of Executive Outcomes. So Executive Outcomes, just as a complete side note, was this the most influential private military company, I'd say, ever. Because back in late 1989, and there was a South African, he was born in Rhodesia, but he's a SAFA, right? He founded this private military company to deal with a bunch of, I think, the communist insurgencies around Africa. And he was very effective. It was a very tightly run operation. And they ended up getting disestablished in 1998. But his influence lingered on. He was advising other African governments at how to deal with insurgencies. And you can praise him for his effectiveness at taking out someone like Joseph Kony. You know, if you remember him back, 10, 15 years ago, he was using child soldiers. He was in the news for that. This guy who ran Executive Outcomes, his name is, it's not coming to me at the moment, Ibn Balo, right? He essentially advised these African governments on how to deal with these insurgent threats. Anyway, so he meets up with a bunch of these Russian officials and, you know, they probably talk about, you know, how to start a PMC. And 4 years later in 2014, that's when the war in Ukraine really starts after the whole Euromaidan thing. Wagner essentially is the VPMC fighting that war on behalf of the Russian state. And they spread their operations out elsewhere into Syria. They provide assistance to Assad in taking out ISIS. And they end up running into conflict with American personnel on the ground. It's quite a wild sort of secret history in a way, what Wagner have been doing around the world. But a lot of their activities are centered in Africa. They're centered in South Sudan. They're centered in the Central African Republic, Madagascar. And the thing with Wagner is that they've got so many different shell companies and other sort of subsidiaries that are also private military. It's hard to determine what is Wagner and what is not.
So basically any PMC that you could trace back to Russia in some way is likely a Wagner operation.
Possibly, not necessarily. And so Wagner has been in the last, well, I'd say about last year, they've been slowly integrated into the Russian Ministry of Defense.
And the Ukrainians then, I mean, we mentioned them briefly in the pitch. I guess the Ukrainian special forces are sworn enemies of Wagner. Did they start to shift their or a little bit of focus into Africa very recently, or is there a history that goes back a bit further there?
Well, it's a very recent thing. Ukraine's been trying to get diplomatic inroads with some of these African countries, partly to sell grain to them. But, you know, just in general, it's good to keep diplomatic ties with everyone. But more recently, Ukrainian special forces have just been trying to fight Russia wherever they can be found. And Russia, as I alluded to before, you know, they've got a lot of gold mines and diamond mines, and, you know, they run some of these timber mills across Africa. And so Ukrainian special forces are trying to disrupt these operations. And so just in July, Ukrainian special forces were supporting, they basically trained the Tuareg people into using drones, attack drones, and they managed to ambush and kill like 80-something Wagner guys in this like village in Mali. Because of course, you know, like Wagner's propping up the government in Mali as they are in Niger, as they are in Burkina Faso.
Right. I do remember seeing some of that. That's right. So it's quite a, maybe a strange story that many of the listeners wouldn't have heard, which is that you had, were they jihadis? So you had these Ukrainian-backed jihadis who ambushed a Russian convoy in the middle of Africa. One of those kinds of stories, just completely.
I believe they were the Tuareg nomadic people, but it could have been jihadis. I mean,
well, I don't know enough, so I can't say.
I mean, yeah, I'm just relying on memory. I mean, the Tuareg half the time they're siding and fighting alongside jihadis, the other half they're fighting against them. So who knows?
Right. And so interesting now, so the Russians are now basically propping up all three of these countries in the Sahel were former French colonies, and all three of them are basically currently being propped up by Russia, strengthening their ties with Russia. And I was doing a little bit of reading on some of them, and it seems they're very heavily reliant on grain imports. So because, as you mentioned right at the beginning, basically a wasteland, all of these countries have no ability to grow their own food. And a big part of it is shipping in grain from either Ukraine or Russia. And that seems to be the key inroad for Russia. I saw the level of underdevelopment in those countries was so bad that Vladimir Putin promised one of them, and I can't remember which one, a grain shipment, and they sent the grain to the nearest port, and then it had to sit there, and they couldn't bring it into the country because the country itself didn't have the ability to even mill grain, had no ability to actually take the grain and turn it into bread. Now, that's just how completely underdeveloped and desolate many of these countries are.
Yeah, and like, you know, I think Mali, 70% of the population is below the poverty line. It's really quite dire in that country.
And in terms of what Wagner is doing there, are they behaving themselves? I suspect there are many UN investigations, US intelligence agencies running, trying to figure out what's going on exactly there. The Russians are known for being a little bit rougher, a little bit less interested in human rights than European countries might be. Are they actually improving these countries, or are they potentially causing a lot of damage?
It's difficult to say, because on one hand, you could make the case that stability is the only thing that matters. You know, if you've got a country that's falling apart and overrun by bandits and rebels, well, how many civilians are dying there? So I'm not justifying human rights abuses, but, like, you know, does a massacre or two really weigh up to, say, you know, bandits killing thousands of people per year, or like selling, you know, hundreds of schoolgirls to forced marriages? I mean, it's really quite difficult to tell, but I mean, the real difficulty of it, and even researching it, is the smoke and mirrors of it all. Can you trust the American State Department with what they're saying? Well, like, how much of that is propaganda? What about the United Nations? What about what the Russians are putting out? So there was this massacre that happened in Mali, this atrocity in the village of Moira. And, you know, like, the numbers of how many died vary by the hundreds. So essentially what happened is the Malian government entered this town using helicopters, you know, to secure it because they thought there were terrorists in the town. Well, it turns out Al-Qaeda was in the town. They opened fire, killed a couple of Wagner dudes, and the Malian government and their Wagner detachment opened fire and killed a bunch of civilians. And, you know, they ended up cordoning off the town. There were mass reprisals. You know, anyone trying to escape the town was met with machine gun fire. And, you know, the Malian government comes out a week later and says, oh, well, you know, they congratulate themselves, pat themselves on the back, saying we killed 203 terrorists. Well, turns out a couple months later, the Human Rights Watch claimed 300 civilians dead. And then a year later, the United Nations Human Rights Report claims 500 dead. And then, you know, the Russian Foreign Ministry comes out and says, oh, this is all disinformation. So, like, who do you trust? Do you trust the Russians? I don't. Do you trust the UN? I don't. I mean, it's really hard to tell. I mean, we know one thing, that civilians would have been, you know, caught in the crossfire. So, yeah, Wagner, how much of that is Wagner? How much of that is the Malian government killing people? I mean, again, it's hard to tell.
That's right. How many of that's Al-Qaeda carrying out reprisals on people that they think are affiliated with the government and so on?
Yeah.
Now, the United Nations, then, did they not have a presence? You'd think this would be ripe for the United Nations to say, we have peacekeeping forces, we have security forces in these countries. Is there no real interest? Because I guess it's not reported in the news, right? If it's nobody in New Zealand knows about this, I didn't know about this until you pitched the idea to talk about it. Just nobody cares. So that's really the situation with the United Nations then.
Well, the issue is that the United Nations, so the one in Mali is called MINUSMA, okay? So it's got this, you know, complicated sort of pretentious name. It's called the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali. And essentially that's a UN peacekeeping force. And, you know, you can read accounts of the way that they, you know, both by journalists, there was a book that came out by a Russian journalist on Wagner, and he interviews a lot of these Wagner personnel in these countries. And basically everyone agrees that they sit on, you know, they sit on their backside doing nothing. And the personnel of these United Nations missions come mostly from the third world, other countries like India, Pakistan, and they get paid handsomely for providing troops and, you know, peacekeeping operations. But a lot of the guys on the ground are quite corrupt. You know, there are reports going back to 2008 of them arming some of these rebel groups for gold. There's plenty of reports about human trafficking and rape, murder, extortion by United Nations peacekeepers. And again, this is all reports. It's not really, we don't know much about what's going on down there, but, you know, they're not very well liked by many of these African governments, because at best, they're doing nothing. At worst, they're like killing their own people.
And so that explains a little bit then why the government of Mali and some of the other Sahel Confederation governments prefer Wagner over the United Nations, basically. So it's not really Russia forcing itself in there. They've actually got the local government that's being propped up, sometimes then by both the United Nations and by Russia, is favoring private military contractors.
Yeah, so these African governments invite the Wagner into these countries essentially to stabilize them because it's a form of building inroads. And with Russia, who they see as a trustworthy or friendly ally, I mean, during the Cold War, the Russians were giving arms and food and helping industrialize these countries, similar to the sort of the Marshall Plan that the Americans enacted in Europe, where, you know, they gave a lot of these countries foreign aid in the form of US dollars to sway them towards the West as opposed to the East. And so, yeah, the Russians during the Cold War did the same thing, except with giving, like, you know, free stuff to the Third World to turn them against the Americans. And so they've got a lot of these diplomatic ties still lingering. And so they tend to trust the Russians more because the Russians haven't really exploited them, let's say.
And with these, I guess we were just talking about like the potential for abuse and so on. There's probably less oversight with them using private military contractors like Wagner versus trying to get the UN to do something. You've got to go through all this paperwork, other oversight. You lose the plausible deniability they might have when they send Wagner in to do their dirty work and so on.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, the cost of direct intervention, you can just look at a country like Afghanistan and how the Americans handled that situation. I remember the former CEO of BlackRock, he was talking in an interview quite recently about how he proposed to Trump back in 2019 that he could hold Afghanistan with a, you know, small garrison of 4,000, 5,000 contractors. And then you just train up the local forces and you kind of, you know, push them into line. You don't need to have, you know, tens of thousands of American personnel. And I think the same thing would be true of Russia and China. Why do you need to operate through your national armies when you can just use a private military company with a tenth of the force? And of course, you get around a lot of the international law hurdles. Again, as you said, plausible deniability. If an atrocity happens, well, the atrocity is on Wagner, it's not, or the atrocity is on, you know, Blackwater, it's not on the American government, it's not on the Russian government.
And the history then in some of the, many of these African countries are basically communist countries, right? During the Cold War, the Europeans pulled out of Africa, decolonized. The British sort of gave up a lot of their colonies to communists. And did this help the Russians now, which, you know, Russia is no longer communist in any meaningful sense, but do they have these existing ties to some of these governments that they've been able to exploit and say the dictators that are end up in power, do they tend to have ties to former communist militias and so on that were roaming around Africa?
Well, it seems that way because a lot of these communist militias, a lot of them were trained in Moscow or trained in Russia. I mean, that's happening today. In fact, there's a lot of African officers being trained in Russian military academies. But yeah, going after like 1991, they would have kept a lot of ties with the Russian embassies. And again, because the French sort of their ability to conduct effective diplomacy declined because I guess it's, you know, they didn't care anymore. Their mission changed. The Russians just swooped in, you know, their liaisons can do a better job at sort of coddling these African leaders.
And is there some stability then in these governments, especially in the last few years, or do they have very frequent regime change in this part of West Africa? It seems like almost every other week that you'll see some coup in some country in Africa, and they very rarely maintain the same leadership for very long. Maybe they have an election, and then the military overthrows the elected government, and then some like rebel group will overthrow the military, and then it just goes around in circles over and over again.
I mean, you just have to go on the Wikipedia page and then, like, you know, type up coups in West Africa, and you have to scroll down several times just to like go through all the different coups since like 1958. You know, there's a coup left, right, and center. So yeah, I guess Wagner does provide stability, but despite that, there'll still be like military juntas. I mean, even when Wagner were backing some of the military juntas that took over these ASS states, there were additional military juntas trying to get rid of those generals, and most of those failed, but, you know, this stuff still happens. And I think the reason why is because the country is, you know, there's a book by Edward Luttwak that was written in the 60s, and it's sort of a half joke book called Coup d'etat. It goes through the various ways that you pull off a coup. And one of the things I think that's quite pertinent to Africa even today is that the communications in Africa are quite minimal. You know, so like the population's out of the loop. The population doesn't really have to be constantly told about the legitimacy of their government. one government goes, another comes. And so, like, does it matter to the typical African, you know, who's working the street market? Not really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're a tribal herdsman out in the desert, or you're working in one of these mines, child labor or whatever it might be, who the government is doesn't really matter, right? What matters is, do you have some food at the end of the day? Can you feed your children? That's the only question that they care about. And there seemed to be sort of this attempt then to force democracy onto them. We've seen this in many countries around the world, and especially recently in like Afghanistan and even Iraq. And the people don't really care about democracy. They care about putting food on the table. And so if there's a dictator, or as you mentioned, a coup, they don't really care. That's not what's going to drive them at the end of the day.
Well, that, and of course, they really only care if their tribal group is in power. And if it's not in power, then, you know, there's resentment builds up, and sometimes it can lead to, you know, atrocities like the Rwandan genocide. So it's, yeah, democracy is really a meaningless word, I'd say, over there. I mean, ECOWAS has tried to reinstate democracy in countries where there's been military juntas. Most recently, they did that in the Gambia in 2017 to, you know, restore democracy. And they still have 2,500 troops garrisoned there. So
democracy at the barrel of a gun.
Exactly.
Right. And it's because I talk about this on the show fairly often. It's a theme that comes into many of the interviews that I do and discussions that I have on the weekly roundup with William McGimpsey as well, is around basically, if you have a multi-ethnic, multiracial society or country, which many of these are, they're basically multi-ethnic, multiracial societies with borders that were drawn up by people who didn't care or who deliberately wanted to pit one tribal group against another. And they can never have a stable democracy because everything just comes down to it being an ethnic headcount. And yeah, there's the only real potential to have democratic stability then is to break those countries up along tribal lines. That doesn't really seem to be on the table either. I mean,
but even if that were to happen, it's like, do they even have the institutions required for democracy? I mean, look at how democracy came about in New Zealand or the Anglosphere in general. We've got, you know, 1,000 years of what is essentially common law precedent to build that up. You know, we've had parliament for how long? The African countries never have had that sort of thing. They've always been run by, you know, like sort of tribal monarchs. So it's always going to, unless they had those sort of institutions gradually build up, it's not going to be easy to put democracy in these countries.
And can you give us an example then of some of these coups that we've discussing, like how regularly do they happen? Really, I mean, as we said, like every other week, but can we be a little bit more specific than saying there's a few, you know, there's dozens and dozens of pages on Wikipedia, but in the last 5 years or so, have we had a handful of coups?
18 attempted coups.
Wow. Okay. That's in just the last 5 years, that's more, a lot more than I expected.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just those three countries. I mean, it's also, you know, countries like, you know, Sudan and, you know, the Democratic Republic of Congo more recently. So half the time they fail, half the time they succeed. It's sort of something you have to flip a coin for.
And then perhaps the most important question I've just thought of is, how successful are they in actually getting rid of most of these Islamic terrorists, fighting Al-Qaeda or ISIS, whichever groups have formed themselves up there? Is there some progress that's now being made to decrease their numbers to actually provide stability, or is there too much fog of war to make a determination like that?
There's probably too much fog of war. I mean, this was an explicit aim of the ASS, was to pull together their military assets to fight these insurgencies that affect all three of those countries. It was that, and of course, you know, to defy ECOWAS, who was threatening intervention in Niger last year. If you can remember that in the news, it looked like West Africa was about to go to war with all these countries about to go to war with one another. So they're pulling together their assets. It might be successful, it might not. You know, the issue is these countries are huge. These militants are constantly moving. Yeah, it's difficult to say.
And one of the other things that was in the news then was the, like you're saying, these countries nearly about to go to war with each other. This was around France as well. They were trying to reestablish their presence in, was it Niger? And they nearly had, was it, they had some influence. Nigeria threatened to go to war with one of these countries over French influence. And nothing really came of it in the end, it seems like.
Yeah, that was over the coup. So the most recent coup was in 2023 when Niger, their military junta, overthrew the quote-unquote democratic government. I mean, how democratic are they? I don't know. But, you know, this military junta overthrew them in July 2023. And so ECOWAS, I guess they were acting on behalf of the French with threatening intervention. And that ended up leading to the French being kicked out late last year, and more recently the Americans this year. Actually, the deadline for the Americans to leave Niger is next week. So they probably are ahead of schedule.
And does that leave just basically Russian influence in Niger and other West African countries? Do you see a lot of influence that China is trying to exert in that area, or perhaps any other players as well?
Well, I mean, I don't think China's really involved in West Africa at the moment. Most of their interest is in the Belt and Road Initiative, which is East Africa, South Africa, and exploiting the resources there. So maybe the Russians have developed a sphere of influence in a sort of backroom agreement with the Chinese. It's kind of hard to tell from the Western point of view.
And what's the overall leadership and stability of Wagner like after Prigozhin? Death and you know, after the role they played in Ukraine, does it look like it's, has a stable leadership and is going to carry on? You referenced
Wagner's been disestablished at the moment, so like you know they're being integrated into the African cause.
Right. So when we talk about Wagner, they're really officially part of the Russian military. Then there's not really a PMC, or is it still?
Wagner has been estimated about 5,000 men, down from, I think, like 45,000 last year. So they've massively shrunk, and that's because they've been assimilated into the African Corps, which is under the direct leadership of the Russian Ministry of Defense.
Right. So we are likely then to see the Russian military take a more formal presence then in West Africa. You'd see that as the likely trajectory of, you know, instead of plausible deniability, you actually actively see Russian military assets deployed in West African countries?
Well, it's hard to tell, because if you do that, then you're going to cast more attention. You're going to encourage the West to get more involved in West Africa and perhaps mount their own interventions. Of course, that's all depending on, you know, what government's in charge. So again, as we said before, plausible deniability and the ability to operate as a sort of semi non-state actor has its advantages when it comes to acting in these countries with impunity.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me to give us these insights into what's going on in West Africa. And it's been very interesting for me, and I hope the listeners have found it interesting as well, because there's basically nothing on the news about any of this. Sometimes some vague mentions of a massacre here and there. That's about it. And so if you've got any final thoughts you'd like to leave with us, and perhaps even, do you have some hope that things will get better in West Africa, or does it look kind of like Haiti, as we talked about several months ago, hopeless, and even for the next, say, in the next decade or two, are we going to actually see these countries develop and stabilize, or does that seem very, very unlikely to you?
It seems unlikely, and actually that's probably a good thing. You know, there's opportunities abound, right? This whole use of private military companies in Africa has kind of flown in the face of a United Nations directive. Back in 2001, a bunch of countries signed this agreement it was effectively to outlaw mercenaries, and PMCs is an extension of that. And right now it looks like American PMCs, European PMCs, possibly Chinese PMCs at some point in the future are all going to be involved in Africa. And so, again, opportunities abound, right? The United Nations looks like it's incompetent, and countries will take advantage of that and maybe throw off the yoke of globalism.
I was reading Bronze Age Mindset recently, and he mentions the son of Margaret Thatcher, I believe, who was involved with some of these PMCs and coups in Africa. He was unfortunately arrested with a connection of overthrowing some government in Africa. But it seems like that age of mercenaries is nowhere near over, because that was sort of the 80s and the 90s, I think, when that was considered to be at its peak. And then it looks like the United Nations worked very hard to suppress it in the early 2000s. And we're basically back now to the soldiers of fortune. If there's anyone listening who wants to go out and make a name for
himself. Well, legally speaking, we're a signatory of that, so we can't actually encourage any of that behavior. We can't have any of those organizations in this country.
No, there are no New Zealand private military contractors. But it's a similar, I mean, we say the same thing when it comes to like Ukraine, right? There's officially no New Zealand involvement in Ukraine. But I saw recently the New Zealand flag being flown by mercenaries for Ukraine who are in, you know, participating in some of the operations, the incursions into Russia that they made themselves. So in all likelihood, there will be New Zealanders involved in one way or another in some of these activities. If not now, they would be down the line.
Yeah, it would seem so. I mean, what I understand with those New Zealanders in Ukraine, they would talk, you know, the New Zealand Defence Force basically said, what you do in your free time is up to you, right? So if you're on leave for 6 months and you want to go fight in Ukraine, well, you know, we've got no part in that.
Yeah, yeah. And officially, of course, they say, no, don't do that. You know, we strongly recommend you don't do that. But yeah, it's kind of...
I mean, what are you fighting for in Ukraine anyway?
Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for today. Once again, I appreciate the insights and to all of the listeners. That was Kaiden McCormick, who's joined us today, and he's a contributor on rightminds.nz, and he's been a good friend of mine for a while, and I enjoy your interest and research into these very, I don't want to say unique or obscure geopolitical situations, but they definitely ones that escape the news, they escape the discussion that most people have. And it's very fascinating to get your insights into what's going on there. And I'm sure that sometime in the near future, we'll have another Right Minds panel. We'll go to some other part of the world and we'll do something like this again.
Right, yeah, it's been a pleasure.
And to all of the listeners, please stick around. We will be right back after this break.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Taking part in conversations and discussions to help find resolutions for the issues of today. This is The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer.
This week in New Zealand history, tomorrow on the 10th of September, marks the anniversary of the 1914 eruption on White Island that killed 10 people. The sulfur that was mined there was used in the manufacture of sulfuric acid and superphosphate fertilizer. The 10 miners were killed when part of the crater wall collapsed, causing a landslide. The only survivor was the mining company's cat, Peter the Great. This would not be the last time that there were fatalities on the dangerous island, with 22 tourists killed in 2019. On the 11th of September 1928, Australian pilots and their New Zealand radio man crossed the Tasman in a Fokker tri-motor named the Southern Cross. They covered 2,670 kilometres in 14 hours and 25 minutes. That's a little bit longer than the 3 or so hours it takes today. As they neared New Zealand, the bad weather improved, and after circling over Wellington, the Southern Cross landed at Wigram Aerodrome in Christchurch at 9:22 a.m. New Zealand time, and the welcome in Christchurch was tremendous. About 30,000 people had made their way there for this auspicious day, including many pupils from schools who were given the day off and public servants who were allowed to take leave until 11 a.m. Now, on the 14th of September 1938, the Social Security Act passed. And from the late 19th century, New Zealand had gained a reputation as the social laboratory of the world and a working man's paradise. And this legislation was the cornerstone of the first Labour government's welfare program, and it overhauled a pension system, extended benefits for families and the unemployed. The Act combined a new free at-the-point-of-use health system that we still have today, with a various array of welfare benefits. And it was financed by a tax of 5%. And that was perhaps a little bit too optimistic. If only we could maintain our social security services today. It's just a 5% income tax, but inevitably, as the has been a supply of social security services, the demand for them has similarly increased. Supporters at the time envisioned a scheme that would protect New Zealanders from the cradle to the grave. On the 8th of September in 1945, New Zealand signed the Manila Pact, and this formed the Southeast Asia Collective Defence Treaty, or the Manila Pact, which aimed to contain the spread of communism in the region. And the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization was formed, CETO. And when the Vietnam War broke out, the US, Australia, and New Zealand governments used this to justify their involvement in Vietnam. But some of its members opposed the war. The treaty organization was ultimately ineffective, and the pact was dissolved in 1977. Now it is time for the book review that I mentioned earlier, and I also referenced it in the interview with Kaiden. And it is a review of the book Bronze Age Mindset. Now, when the Bronze Age Mindset was published in 2018, it became a bestseller and very popular among many of America's elites. In the global online right, it quickly reached the status of a cult classic. I never had the reason to pick it up until recently, because I wanted to understand a little bit more about why some of the world's most rich and powerful were attracted to such an obvious work of right-wing reactionary thought. The book identifies its author only as Bronze Age Pervert, which tells you a little about the man and his work. It is sometimes a little perverted and crude, but not in a way that was overly off-putting. The style of the book is unique, enjoyable, and somewhat indescribable. He invents his own sentence structure and words, and which even if you've never heard of, you can always immediately intuit the meaning of. The author has recently been identified as Costin Alamaru, an American academic of Romanian descent. I also picked up an older book, Sun and Steel by Yukio Mishima, which was published in 1968 at the same time, and I have been reading it directly after. The latter was an influence on the former, and I picked up similar themes. And I was particularly interested in how these works of pagan philosophy interacted with Christianity, in particular as many of the anti-woke elite seem to be gravitating towards the ideology of Sun and Steel, as it was in the Bronze Age. And so Bronze Age Mindset is very much an un-Christian work. I hesitate to say anti, because we are some fellow travelers in this war against a common foe, and the author identifies us as allies. So perhaps this Bronze Age Mindset could become an enemy of Christianity later, but we must first have the total defeat of the modern left before that can be debated seriously. The author identifies that pagans do not have faith, and the very idea of faith is his brief criticism of Christianity, as faith, he says, makes men weak. He is thoroughly Nietzschean in that regard, and we are gods could be the summation of the Bronze Age mindset. I'm not really the target audience of this book, but his rage really is aimed at the disaffected young man in a decadent and effeminate world. The decadence will not last, but he is not content to be a spectator. He wishes to work to actively bring Babylon to its knees, not by cultivating virtue, but by multiplying its vices until the corruption gives way to an age of barbarism. I would identify this archetype with the scourge of God that we see in much of the Bible and European history. He also praises the great explorers, even the conquistadors, as much as the Greek warriors. Even the modern mercenary can have the kind of life that he sees as the highest good, but many international rules now make that virtually impossible to attain. To be free from gynocratic rule, men must become pirates and give up on the current order. There is no opportunity to reform, but only to survive its collapse. And that's where the book is pretty nihilistic. There is no positive view of the family, although he begrudgingly admits that having one is necessary to continue the species. He believes that this is the death of a man, but I disagree. Family drives men to greatness, but the Bronze Age mindset doesn't make that leap. He only calls on men to prepare for the coming age of barbarism and to join the Brotherhood of the Damned. It's a story for the young man already left behind, with nothing left but to watch the world burn, or to be the one doing the burning. The main positive idea that the author puts forward is that of cultivating strength and bodybuilding, but I think that this is best discussed in a separate review of the Japanese author Yukio Mishima's work, Sun and Steel, which is a story for another time. Now it is time for the promised music by German composer Richard Wagner. Since I interviewed Kaiden about some of the activities of the Wagner mercenaries, active in West Africa at the moment on behalf of the Russian government, we'll return after this music to cover the Battle of Waterloo before I wrap up the show a little early today. Wagner is very famous for his operas, but opera is a bit of a love-it-or-hate-it genre, so I will play it safe and go with one of his symphonies. This is the final movement of Wagner's symphony in C major, played by the Tokyo Metropolitan Symphony Orchestra.
You're listening to The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer. Politics, power, and culture. Right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
If you caught the show on Friday, I interviewed Peter Berenger from the Alternative for Deutschland, AFD. And if you haven't listened to it, their replay will be up on the RCR website and in the app. But I thought perhaps that I would cover a positive battle, one in which the Germans featured positively, because I heard that even part of their World War I history, even their Prussian military tradition, is basically illegal for them to speak of positively. And if not illegal, I guess at least unacceptable socially. So we did, of course, have situations where the British and Germans were very much allied. So it was British policy to keep the continent divided. And so they would unite with the Germans against the French and with the French against the Germans, depending on who was the most dominant at the time. So the Battle of Waterloo now, adapted as always from Nigel Cawthorne's The Great Battles of History. After a short exile on Elba, Napoleon escaped, returned to France, and went on to rebuild his empire. The Battle of Waterloo in 1815 was Napoleon Bonaparte's final defeat. It ended 23 years of war between France and the other European powers. After his catastrophic invasion of Russia in 1812, his comprehensive defeat by the Duke of Wellington in the Peninsular War, Napoleon had been forced to abdicate and the Bourbon monarchy was restored. Although exiled to the Isle of Elba, he stayed there less than a year. In 1815, Napoleon gave his guards the slip and returned to France. As he crossed the Alps, Republican peasants rallied to him. Louis XVIII sent Napoleon's old comrade in arms, Marshal Michael Ney, who had now sworn an oath to the Bourbons to capture him. Ney promised the king that he would bring Napoleon back to Paris in a cage. However, Michael Ney changed his mind when his soldiers cheered Napoleon and rejoined the emperor. At the time, the European powers were meeting at the Congress of Vienna. Their business was to reorganize the continent after the devastation of the Napoleonic Wars. Hearing news that Napoleon was marching on Paris at the head of an army, the Tsar Alexander turned to Wellington and said, "It is for you to save the world again." By the end of May, Napoleon had raised an army of 184,000 men, and with a force of 124,000, he moved north to the Belgian border. His aim was to maneuver his forces between the 93,000-strong Anglo-Dutch force under Wellington and a 115,000-man Prussian army under Field Marshal Gebhard Liebknecht von Blücher. He then hoped to defeat the two armies separately, pushing Wellington up towards the Belgian coast and Blücher back to Prussia. Napoleon ordered Ney to cross the border and to march to Les Quatre Bras, an important crossroads on the way to Brussels. And then, on the 16th of June, he engaged Wellington. Although the French had overwhelming superiority, Wellington managed to withdraw in good order and regroup at Mont-Saint-Jean, just south of Waterloo. The same day, Napoleon inflicted a serious defeat on Blücher at Ligny, but the Prussian army was not completely destroyed. Napoleon sent Marshal Grouchy to pursue the remnants. Napoleon had succeeded in his plan of keeping the two armies apart, but he had mistakenly thought that the Prussians were finished, and so he set off after Wellington. Vastly outnumbered, Wellington's only chance was to hold his ground until the Prussians sent reinforcements. He chose his battle carefully, picking a place where he could fight the kind of defensive battle that he had mastered. The ridge at Mont-Saint-Jean ran for just 3 miles, and he put most of his men out of sight behind it, while others garrisoned at the farmhouses of Hougoumont, Le Haye-Saint, and Papelot. The French drew up on an opposing ridge just 1,300 yards away. Some 140,000 men and 400 guns would be squeezed into a battlefield of little more than 3 square miles, which gave Napoleon little chance to employ the complex maneuvers he had excelled at. He would need to attack Wellington's position straight on. Wellington concentrated most of his strength on his right flank, where the ridges were closer. He left the flank, lightly manned in the hope that it would be reinforced by the Prussians. The forward positions, such as Hougoumont and Les Haye-Saint, were designed to act as breakers in a French attack. Under Wellington's command were British troops, men of the King's German Legion, Hanoverians, Dutch, Belgians, Brunswickers, and Nausers. This gave him just over 12,000 cavalry, 50,000 infantry, just over 5,000 gunners with 156 artillery pieces. The French fielded nearly 16,000 cavalry, 50,000 infantry, and over 7,000 gunners with 246 guns. Napoleon would have had an overwhelming superiority if he had recalled Grouchy's troops of some 33,000 men. As it was, they were held down by 17,000 men of Blücher's rear guard at Vavres, some 8 miles to the east, while Blücher's main force of around 28,000 was on its way to reinforce Wellington. It would save the day. Napoleon was unwell. The piles that plagued him in his later years were playing up, and he was testy. He pooh-poohed the idea that Blücher might relieve Wellington and refused to recall Grouchy. Dismissing Wellington as a sepoy general, Wellington's early military experience had been in India, he claimed that he could overwhelm him with a frontal assault. When it was pointed out that Wellington had not suffered a single defeat during the Peninsular War, Napoleon exploded with rage. Not only did Napoleon underestimate his opponent, but he made another fatal blunder. It had been raining for the last few days, making the going heavy for cavalry and infantry assaults. Instead of attacking at the first opportunity on the morning of the 18th of June, he delayed until midday in order to allow the field to dry. This gave Blücher's Prussians the time they needed to reach the battlefield. The battle began with a diversionary attack on Hougoumont under the command of Napoleon's brother Jerome. The idea was to lure Wellington away in order to weaken his centre, but Jerome was jealous of his brother's military record, and so he tried to take the chateau in earnest. Soon his entire division was involved in a full-scale battle. As heavy fire from prepared positions took its toll on the attackers, Jerome had to call for reinforcements, which weakened the French centre. He had achieved the opposite of Napoleon's intentions. For Wellington, it was vital that Hougoumont be held, otherwise his right would have been turned and his position on the ridge would have been untenable. However, just 13 companies of Coldstream Guards were sent to support Hougoumont, while the position held down a quarter of Napoleon's infantry. Napoleon underestimated the resilience of the British guardsmen. At 1 p.m, Napoleon received an intercepted message from General Bulow, who was leading the Prussian advance guard. It was addressed to Wellington, and it informed him that Bulow was in the area of St. Lambert. Napoleon sent cavalry and infantry units to hold off Bulow and dispatched the order to Grouchy, recalling him. But it was too late. The order did not reach Grouchy until 5 p.m, when it was too late to help. With Blücher on his way, it became even more urgent to dislodge Wellington from his ridge. Napoleon ordered the troops on his right, General de Erlon's corps, some 20,000 men, to move forward in formation. They came under attack from the garrison at La Haye-Sainte and suffered heavy casualties. Nevertheless, they succeeded in capturing Papelot and La Haye-Sainte, but a terrible mistake had been made. The French did not advance up the bridge in narrow battalion columns, but instead in broad divisional columns, 200 men wide and 24 to 27 men deep. This presented the British gunners with an unmissable target. De Erlon's men had little artillery or cavalry support. The British guns were drawn up behind a thick hedge and could rain down fire on them with impunity. When the depleted French ranks reached the top of the ridge, they were met with a volley of musket fire. A bayonet charge was made by 30,000 redcoats. Two British cavalry brigades moved in for the kill. Papelot was retaken, and 3,000 Frenchmen were taken prisoner. In all the excitement, the cavalry charged the French guns. French lancers counterattacked, and over 1,000 British cavalrymen were lost. But even that could not disguise the fact that Napoleon's knockout blow had failed. By 3 p.m., Napoleon knew he could expect no help from Grouchy. He decided the linchpin of the whole battle was La Haye-Sainte, and he ordered Ney to take it. As he prepared the assault, Ney could see the wounded British soldiers making their way down the road to Brussels. This put it into his head that Wellington was retreating. Without artillery or infantry support, Ney ordered his 5,000 cavalrymen to charge up the ridge in what he believed would be a decisive attack. When they saw the French approaching, Wellington's infantry formed themselves into squares behind the ridge. Because of this, French cavalry made little impact when they reached them, and Wellington counterattacked with his own cavalry. Another 10,000 French horsemen were sent in. They made little impression on the infantry squares, but the French managed to take La Haye-Sainte. The French artillery also began to take its toll on Wellington's centre, leaving it weak and vulnerable. Ney was convinced that with one more push he would break through, so he sent a message to Napoleon asking for more troops. "More troops?" yelled Napoleon. "Where does he expect me to get them from? Make them?" His reserves had been sent to hold off the Prussians, who had captured a nearby town. Wellington then took personal command of the Brigade of Brunswickers and mounted on his favourite grey, Copenhagen. He rode to fill the hole that Ney had punched in his line. The Prussians were now arriving on the battlefield. Napoleon spread the word among his troops that these were Grouchy's men coming to support them. When they discovered that this was a lie, their morale plummeted. Napoleon could have saved his army at that point if he had withdrawn, but his Imperial Guard had held the Prussians on the left, and at 7 p.m. he withdrew several battalions in the belief that one more charge up the centre by the veterans of the Imperial Guard would break the British on the ridge. To the beat of a drum, the Imperial Guard marched up the ridge, magnificently attired, their tall bearskin caps decorated with long red feathers. Wellington ordered his men to lie down so that shot from the French artillery would fly harmlessly over their heads. When the Imperial Guard reached the top of the ridge, they were met with a fusillade of musket fire and grape shot. With the Imperial Guard just 20 yards away, Wellington is reputed to have given the order, "Up, guards, and at 'em!" They leapt to their feet, let off a volley of fire at close range, and then charged with fixed bayonets. The Imperial Guard were Napoleon's elite, and the guardsmen pushed them back. Seeing this, the cry went up among the French, "Les gardes reculent!" The guard is retreating. This was the first retreat in their history, and with it, French morale collapsed completely. As the Imperial Guard were pushed back, they were ambushed by a reserve brigade hiding in the cornfields. Some turned and fled, while others screened Napoleon's retreat by forming a square in the middle of the battlefield. Meanwhile, Wellington raised his hat and ordered a general advance that swept the French from the field. At 9 o'clock that night, Wellington and Blücher met up at La Belle Alliance, with Blücher thought would make a good name for the battle. But Wellington insisted on the old tradition that he had built up, naming his battles after the place in which he had slept the night before, so the battle was called Waterloo. The French lost 25,000 men, who had either been killed or wounded, and 9,000 more had been captured, along with 220 guns. Wellington's army lost 15,000 troops, and Blücher's about 8,000. The Duke of Wellington declared the Battle of Waterloo a damned serious business, the nearest run thing you ever saw in your life. With the Prussians in pursuit, Napoleon tried to rally his men 7 miles to the south, but it was an impossible task because his units had lost all cohesion. He returned to Paris, and 4 days later, he abdicated for a second time. Hoping to take a ship for the United States, Napoleon headed for Rochefort, but the port was blockaded by the Royal Navy. He appealed to the British for protection, and on the 15th of July, he boarded HMS Bellerophon. By this time, he was exiled to the remote island of St. Helena off Africa in the South Atlantic, where he died in 1821 at the age of 51.
Taking part in conversations and discussions to help find resolutions for the issues of today. This is The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer.
The following replay is an interview that I did with Sophia Toth-Biro from the European Conservative on the 21st of June. And this was shortly after the European parliamentary elections. And one of the themes from that election was how well the French and German and other conservative and right-wing parties did, especially with the youth vote shifting in their direction. I think this gels well with the interview I did on Friday with Peter Beringer from the AFD on, again, how they were getting a lot of young votes in their local elections. And if you were around at the beginning of the show, I did an analysis of Trump support in New Zealand, which of course is not relevant in the sense that New Zealanders vote for Trump, but you could see a massive surge of support for Trump among young people in New Zealand. And I think these trends are very, very important. So enjoy this interview from June and see if the trends still hold up. And I will be back next week with a full show, a full schedule. Until then, enjoy. We are joined now by Sophia Toth-Biro from the European Conservative, which is Europe's leading conservative English language publication on philosophy, politics, art, and contemporary affairs. In addition to their quarterly print magazine, the European Conservative publishes daily news stories and analyses, commentary, interviews, and reviews, as well as investigative reports. Well, good afternoon, Sophia, and welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. So as you made a perfect introduction of the European Conservative, we are, as you said, an online website and a quarterly magazine. We publish news, essays, commentary, analyses, and interviews. And our goal is to be a platform where Europeans and people outside of Europe go to if they want to read about the latest political maneuverings in different European countries and to see behind the curtains, so to speak. That is why we don't just write news regurgitating what the most dominant platforms are saying, but we rather analyze news. So if you go to our platform, europeanconservative.com, you'll see that for this specific reason, our news stories are much longer than usual. And 1.5 a year ago, we opened our Brussels office. In Brussels, and even more so than in politics, the media is painfully dominated by the left. So it was obvious that our first physical office has to be in the heart of Europe, or as we call it, in the lion's den. And now we are the biggest conservative media in Brussels. What makes the European Conservative unique is that we don't only focus on politics, but also on culture, philosophy, beauty. And with all that, we take our small share in the efforts to preserve the Western civilization.
Well, thank you for that. That's quite the introduction. And I thought I'll have some follow-up questions, but you answered some of those as well. Like, I was really wondering how it is that you're placed in Brussels. Is the culture of Brussels at odds with conservatism, or is that just the impression that we get that Brussels is say, very left-wing, or is that just only just the, you know, I guess the European Parliament part of it, the bureaucracy?
Well, yes. I mean, when it comes to Brussels, the Brussels bubble, it is incredibly left-wing. And so, but there are, of course, conservative forces within the bubble, also in the European Parliament. So when we opened our office, which I mentioned, this is the first physical office of the European Conservative, everybody was working remotely before that. They welcomed us with open arms, our fellow conservatives, because there were no platforms to which they could give their statements on different issues. Politico, even conservatives, woke up with reading. The first thing they did in the morning was reading Politico to inform about like what happened in the past days or that morning. So having an office there, like of a conservative media outlet, I think it's a breath of fresh air to many people. So I think we did the right choice, or made the right choice, when we opened our office there.
Now, I understand with the recent European elections, the conservative or more right-wing groups, the identitarian blocs as well, picked up some extra European MPs. Could you give us a little bit of an overview on how the European election went? Who were the winners and the losers of that election?
Yes. So it is clear that Europeans are fed up with open borders and the insecurity that comes with that. The victories of Marine Le Pen's National Rally, the Austrian Freedom Party, Hungary's Fidesz, and Giorgia Meloni's Fratelli d'Italia, among others, clearly shows this. Also, voters made it clear that they don't want policies that destroy the economy, the industry, the farmers, and would force them to buy expensive electric cars or eat bugs even. People don't want to hear more about the absurd net zero. And so the overwhelming vote against green parties across Europe has sent a powerful message. So all political groupings on the left lost seats compared to the 2019 election results, the biggest losers being the Greens and the Renew groups, who altogether lost 45 seats, if I'm not incorrect, at this year's election. It is also worth mentioning or noting that on the 9th of June, on election night, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen declared that center held, because the European People's Party EPP group got the highest number of seats in the parliament. Well, that might be true for the time being, but Europeans clearly want a change, and the number of non-attached members and newly elected members not yet allied to any of the political groups can quickly change this status quo with their 87 seats.
And how much power do the European MPs have? I've heard it say that the Parliament, the European Parliament, is not real in the sense that the bureaucrats run everything and the MPs are just there. They turn up and they don't really get to do anything.
Well, every policy that comes out of Brussels first has to go through the European Parliament. So it does matter who represents Europeans there. And also there's a not super self-evident connection between the Commission and the Parliament, because the new commissioners have to be approved by the members of the European Parliament. So, and the Commission is the most powerful force in European politics. So even though members of the European Parliament play a different role, their role is not insignificant at all.
And what kind of changes can we expect? What kind of changes are you expecting in Europe in the next term?
Well, yes, when it comes to the future of Europe, that's a different topic. We could talk about the future now. Well, the future of Europe will depend, in my opinion, on whether patriotic sovereigntist forces will be able to form strong alliances to counter the federalist agenda of the left and liberal forces. I recommend reading the Patriotic Manifesto, recently released by an alliance forged by Herbert Kickl. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. I apologize for that. The chairman of the Austrian Freedom Party, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, and former Czech PM Andrej Babiš, which clearly states that the way forward is a Europe of strong, proud, and independent nations, free in their determination to live and cooperate in concord with each other. Another key issue will be the economy and competitiveness. And I believe, not just because I'm a biased Hungarian, but objectively speaking, I believe the Hungarian government's strategy of connectivity is perhaps the recipe of success. So rather than viewing emerging global players as enemies, and I refer to China and Latin American countries, Europe should look for ways to cooperate that is mutually beneficial, but puts Europe's interests first. And I think Europe should stop shooting itself in the foot so to speak, with net zero and carbon neutral ideas that and counter climate change in a more sensible way. For example, promoting nuclear energy that has been proven to be the greenest energy source so far. And yet this is another fact that the left chose to be blind to when it comes to the greenness of nuclear energy. So the next couple of weeks and months will be very interesting, as I said, to see where the non-attached members and new MEPs will go to, which groupings, if they will choose to join any groupings at all, and whether this new patriotic movement will manage to forge a strong alliance with other parties.
I am glad to hear you say that Europe should look to Hungary. Actually, in New Zealand, we have a conservative conference on today at the moment run by the Family First group called the Forum on the Family. And when I was there last year, the guest of honor was the Hungarian ambassador. So we have some connections here with conservatives in New Zealand and conservatives in Hungary. So it's great to have that connection.
I'm glad.
Now, one of the things that I heard about the election, European election, was a big swing from younger voters to the right wing, and that the trend or the expectation, you could say, has been from the Green Party, from the left, that people, the young people, will vote for the left, they'll vote for green policy. And when I was looking at some of the polls from, say, Germany especially, it looked like large numbers of young voters were going to the right instead of to the left. And is that true? And why is that happening?
It is true. I would start with a quote from Churchill, who said that if you are not a liberal when you are young, you have no heart. And if you are not a conservative when old, you have no brain. Well, that wisdom seems no longer to be true. The way I see it, many young people have lost faith in the left-wing and liberal partisan forces. They have seen the disastrous consequences of their policies and also the hypocrisy about climate change and the so-called rule of law. I refer to, for example, the corruption engulfing the left-wing liberal parties in the European Parliament, but also the fact that their countries are changing beyond recognition because of the uncontrolled mass immigration. So young people also see that the left-wing liberal parties are pushing ideological issues such as LGBTQ and culture war, rather than focusing on or tackling real problems like rising inflation and housing crisis. So they, young people, want their future to be theirs. And the current path the left is on promises no future, and they are starting to seeing it.
People here in New Zealand who sort of hear a bit about European politics, we often get it through, say, big names or big events that happen over in Europe. And there's a lot more that we hear from these identitarian groups. Like we've had several speakers come through New Zealand and Australia, Lauren Southern, you've probably heard of, and many years ago now. And they were more so connected with these identitarians rather than just conservatives. Could you sort of explain, I guess, the difference in you? Like, is there a conflict between conservatives and more populist identitarian groups? Like in many of these European countries as well, we see the vote share of conservative parties, like the traditional or the, you know, who are supposed to be conservative parties, collapse. And we see these more populist parties, winning larger numbers of seats because of that. What's driving that? Is it conservatism losing out, or is it just a change in what it means?
Well, we've been trying to determine how to call, let's say, conservative forces, because they're, you know, the scale is quite large on the right. Should we call them populist movements? Should we call them conservative movements? Because, for example, what you see in the UK is the Conservative Party is everything but conservative when you look, exactly, take a close look at their policies. So we decided to call them sovereigntists, which doesn't cover all, but cover it all, but at least gives you an idea of what kind of right-wing approach we're looking, or the people looking to. So I mean, from in my opinion, when it comes to being conservative or being right-wing or being sovereigntist, like, if, like, you know, it's commercial time, apologize, I apologize, but we've recently released our guide to the 2024 EU elections. And even though the elections already happened, it is worth reading because we deeply analyze the five big topics that have been dominating and will be dominating the political discussion for many years. The mass migration, immigration, Green Deal, security and defense, rule of law, and I forgot the fifth one because I might have amnesia. But if you look at those five issues and if you see what kind of approaches, let's say, sovereigntist forces are taking, I think that's the way forward, regardless of how we call them. So what we need is a united right. And if there are, let's say, populists or there are more conservatives or sovereigntists, they should join forces regardless of what we call them, because that's the only way we can tackle the globalist agenda. So I'm sad to see that in the European Parliament, for example, ECR is super divided when it comes to forming alliances, and one of the fraction dominating percentage of ECR is leaning towards the EPP. So I wish that conservatives or right-wingers, regardless of what we call them, join forces and stand strong against those forces who promises no future to Europe.
And just for an example for you from New Zealand, at the moment we have a coalition government that's basically liberals, conservatives, libertarians and nationalists, you know, in a right-wing government together. And it's working quite well for us at the moment, but it only worked because we had a really bad left-wing Labour government for a while. But definitely we can all work together if we put some of our differences aside and focus on, like you said, the key issues affecting our country, or in your case, you know, the whole continent. Especially the mass immigration comes up over and over again, I think, in these European countries. And that really is, you would say, the biggest issue is border security, illegal immigration. For years and years, millions and millions of people just coming into the country with no checks and no security at all.
Yes.
Now, we've recently had some elections in France. I think that only the first round of elections, with the second round happening end of the week. What are your thoughts on the results there?
So, first of all, the polls were not lying. They were quite right. Marine Le Pen's, just to give the readers some numbers, currently Marine Le Pen's National Rally and its allies come out on top in the first round of the French parliamentary elections. National Rally bagged 33% of the vote across the country, followed by the leftist Popular Front Alliance with 28% and Macron with 20.8%. But as Hélène Delazon, our Paris correspondent, stated in her recent analysis, it would be naive to underestimate the capacity of the current political system dominated by the left, because it will do everything to defend itself in order to survive and prevent Bardella's ascension. So it will not be easy. It will not be an easy win for the National Rally, as the two other electoral groups are coordinating their moves smartly, which might result in further political chaos. And speaking of chaos, in some French cities, Antifa and other leftist protesters set fires to express outrage at the results. In Paris, thousands of Islamists and leftists rallied against the so-called far right. And at those demonstrations, protesters waving the flag of Palestine, the flag of pride. But as our columnist Rod Dreher reminded, you could not see a single French tricolor there. However, at the National Rally's victory party on Sunday, French voters were waving the tricolor and singing the Marseillaise. So that image, I think, speaks for itself. And I mean, Macron's migration policy and the French's fear of further escalation of the Russian-Ukrainian war were, I think, the two most determining factors that drove the French to the right and abandoned the centrist establishment along with its liberal allies. So let's see what happens in the second round. But yes, it's going to be a close call for the conservatives, I think.
Yeah, do you think, and I'm looking at the numbers and we're half on the other side of the world, so it's hard to know for sure, but it looks sort of like everyone is ganging up on Marianne Le Pen to make sure she doesn't get a majority. Could you, I don't know if you could make a prediction. I mean, what happens if she does get a majority? What happens if her party doesn't get a majority? I say she, but it's the, so Bordello is would be the prime.
Yes.
And he's quite young as well, I believe only 28. And it's great to see more young people, you know, reaching these positions of prominence and trying to direct the future of their countries and of Europe.
Yes. So if Marine Le Pen's party doesn't get an absolute majority, I think Bordello already said that he is ready to cohabitating with Macron, meaning that, and that would be a very interesting situation, having a centrist president, meaning Macron, and a conservative prime minister, meaning Bordello. So I'm not sure what kind of situation that would result in, but it will be certainly interesting to see how the number or the battle for France unfolds.
And then the last question there, circling back to the future of Europe, do you see this is this just going to be a one-off act of, say, rebellion against the establishment, trying to control borders, trying to stop war from escalating on the borders of Europe? And, you know, you've got these young people getting behind these movements. Is this something that you see on the ground as something that might fade away, something that might be betrayed, something that might be contained? Or do you see this as the future? Do you have a lot of hope for the future now?
I do. I do have a lot of hope for the future. And as I said, everywhere I look, I see that people wanting change. And this is not the kind of will that would just fade away from one moment to another. If I'm looking at Europe only, the past 5 years before this election had disastrous consequences. And people are feeling it on their skin. I mean, this is like the idea that European politics or politics don't have direct impact on the life of everyday Europeans. That's a lie. Everything that comes out of Brussels or happens on a national level has direct or indirect effects on our everyday lives. And people are seeing it. The most recent and most accurate example, I think, the recent farmers' protests. I'm not sure if I can make a politically incorrect joke, but I heard someone say that veganism and communism are fine unless you love food. And if you take veganism out of the equation and put net zero or the Green Deal in there, you get the same result. So people are putting those, like, connecting the dots that they weren't be able to connect before, because politicians are making politics and policies opaque, so they feel distant, but they are not. They have direct consequences. So, and people, as I said, people realize that and they clearly want to change. So I don't think that this so-called rebellion would just disappear from one day to another.
That's a good way of sort of putting it. Yeah, you can have net zero or you can have food. You can have open borders or you can have a country, but you can never have both of those things at the same time.
Exactly.
And is there any final thought that you'd like to leave the listeners with and perhaps remind them of where they can follow your work and the work of the European Conservative? And to the listeners, we will be back right after the break as well. And we've been talking with Sophia Toth-Biro, and I will give you the last word.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, please do follow us on our social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Getter, and we will soon launch our Instagram page. And I would promote my own monthly news show, TCTV Inside Brussels. The next episode will be released on the 24th of July. So please take a look at it, and I hope you'll enjoy it.
And to anyone listening to the playback later, we will have all of these links on the website with the recording. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you'd like to contact us here at Reality Check Radio, you can email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio or text us by sending your message to 2057.
Well, that is all for today. On behalf of the RCR team, thank you for listening to all of the shows today, and I do hope you have a great rest of your week. The replays will start right after this and continue on until breakfast with Paul Brennan, returning tomorrow on Tuesday at 7 a.m. And the final piece of music this week is going to be Beethoven's commemoration of Wellington's victory. You don't always make the connection, but this was a fun piece of music that Ludwig von Beethoven composed for this contemporary event. A glorious victory of the English, the Dutch, and German forces over the French under Napoleon. And it is played here by the American Symphony Orchestra.
Thanks for tuning in to the Dialogue with Dewa de Boer. You can catch the Dialogue replays on our website at www.realitycheck.radio/replays.